You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Just a quick couple of notes before we start this podcast. While the Second City is not currently doing live shows or live workshops, we have moved all our work online. So if you go to www.secondcity.com, you're going to find links to take improv classes, writing classes, acting classes. We even have a new kids camp where kids as young as 7 can go for better part of a day to take some improv classes. We're also doing corporate workshops and keynotes and personalized virtual improv shows. And we're creating new shows for the public, and that's going to launch very, very soon. So head over to secondcity.com and get all that information, and we'll see you soon.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting Yes And is Michelle King. Michelle is the director of inclusion at Netflix and a leading global expert in gender and organizations. She used to head up the UN Women's Global Innovation Coalition for Change and was an advisory board member for Girl Up, the United Nations Foundation's Adolescent Girl Campaign. She has written for Forbes and for Thrive, Harvard Business Review, and she's also hosting the weekly podcast The Fix. She has a new book. It's called The Fix, Overcome the Invisible Barriers That Are Holding Women Back at Work. Michelle King, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such a big topic, and it was something that I sort of discovered when I was doing my PhD research. Mm-hmm. I had to do all these interviews, and I was interviewing, you know, men and women from two different organizations, and consistently I found with men and male leaders in particular, is that, you know, when I talked about, you know, what are the barriers women face in your organization and trying to advance, or, you know, how are women struggling to advance, like what are some of the difficulties that you're seeing, you know, leaders would just consistently say, you know, there's no barriers, women are given the same opportunity as men, you know, we treat everybody in the same way, workplaces are meritocracies. And it was really just so confronting because I didn't understand how, you know, people could possibly believe this, given that there's 8% of women in leadership positions throughout the entire organization. Like, it literally made no sense. And so, you know, I was super frustrated in that process. And it was about halfway when I kind of realized, oh, wow, you know, this is actually the finding. The finding is that leaders aren't aware of how inequality works in organizations or how people experience organizations differently or, you know, how organizations aren't hardwired for difference, right? So they're really hardwired to support an ideal type of worker to succeed. And so that tends to be a white, middle-class, heterosexual, able-bodied male. And so the more you sort of differ from that ideal, the more challenging it's going to be for you to advance at work. And, you know, it's just really the way organizations were created right from the beginning and the challenges that then creates for anybody who's slightly different from that ideal. And so that really became my work. That's what started this whole book, is to try and disrupt people's denial by sharing, you know, what the barriers are that women face throughout their careers. And importantly, really importantly, you know, what the challenges are that men experience because of gender inequality. I mean, that's something nobody talks about, and it's really important. And so, you know, we're all in this together, and that's why it's so critical that leaders take a role in, you know, fixing workplaces.
Yeah, and what I really appreciated about the book is the way you sort of trace back all the presuppositions that we have about work and workplaces. So the basic premise for the book is that workplaces were never designed or constructed for women, certainly not moms, or people of color, and I think we have a sense
that this patriarchy is a thing that has always been around, but you actually trace it back more to like the advent of the agricultural revolution, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was just interested, right? I was just interested in like, hey, where did all this start? Like, who came up with this crazy idea that men are, you know, more valued than women, or that masculinity is somehow more valuable than femininity? Like, where did that come from? And so I just looked back into history and did a bit of research, really trying to understand some of the roots of this. And, you know, people are kind of, there's a lot of different theories on how it came about. But fundamentally, where we started seeing this play out from a work perspective is how we value the contributions of men and women differently, right? And so that's really where it started. You know, men were able to farm and go out and, you know, hunt or, you know, create wealth. From a monetary perspective in terms of selling any of the produce they created. And over time, you know, that became valued. And women staying at home was just sort of what was deemed less valuable. And, you know, men, I talk about in my book, but they've really got a head start in thinking about, you know, organizations and how to design it and what works and power structures. And so really what's happened since the beginning of time is, you know, men and power, that has become sort of integrated as one idea. You know, when you think of a leader or you think of somebody powerful, you're going to think of a man. And at the same time, organizations are designed to ensure that men maintain that power. And so that's kind of what's got us into the mess that we're in today, is that, as you say, organizations, you know, they were never designed for difference. They were really designed for one type of individual. The thing is, though, is that nobody really fits that ideal, or a very small segment of the population do, which is why a lot of leadership teams look, think, and act and behave in the same way. And so there's really a benefit to everybody in creating an environment that is designed for difference and gives people not only the freedom to behave differently, but also values people for that. So I think that's really the key in terms of creating what I call cultures of equality, right, where people are valued for their differences rather than their differences being something they have to overcome.
And you touched on this earlier, you know, there's so many people walking around who talk about that we live in a post-racial, I mean, I don't know how they could say we live in a post-racial time now, but that has been a topic of conversation, and this idea that the playing field is now level. And I thought about this just in the very simple idea that most of the institutions and practices and traditions and culture that we live in are descendant to us from a time when women couldn't vote. I mean, that simple act alone says so much and really counters that whole argument that somehow we've moved past this.
You know, I talk about race a lot in my book because that's my work, particularly as a white woman, and I'm not afraid to talk about race. In fact, it's my job to talk about it. And, you know, I have a whole chapter in the book on privilege, on my white privilege, and how that works. And the interesting thing about denial, it's really fascinating, is this has been a problem when it comes to racism for years. So, you know, people either saying, I don't see color, or, you know, people sort of just kind of dismissing the different lived experiences of inequality. And, you know, just because you don't experience something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's actually your privilege that ensures that you never have to experience it. I mean, I always say the greatest privilege we have as white people is to remove inequality that, you know, we never ourselves have to experience. And so I think the job with all of this is to disrupt your own denial. Mm-hmm. And that starts with really understanding how people's lived experiences are different. And, you know, for me, I focus on organizations in particular because that's my area of expertise. But this does play out sort of more broadly in society. But I think starting in workplaces makes a lot of sense because it gives a nice framework for how we can interact differently in workplaces and how we can understand, you know, the different experiences over a course of a career, because it's too easy to assume that just because you experience it this way, that so does everybody else. And particularly when you're in a position of power, like, you know, the white person, it's easy to say, well, I've never experienced that, so it mustn't exist. And that's just your denial or your bias talking or your privilege talking, quite frankly. So that's, you know, the work, I think the hardest part with all of this is everybody in every conference I talk to, every interview I do, people are like, hey, give me the 5 things that I can do to solve this. And I'm like, look, if it was that easy, we would have solved this years ago. The reason this is difficult is because a lot of the work begins with us. you know, people don't like that. So a lot of the work, awareness is the work. Awareness is the action. Like, becoming aware of the stuff is the starting point, because then you can take informed action, right? So then you know the challenges people experience. You can look out for them. And when they play out at work, you can speak up. You can be an ally. You can, you know, disrupt what's happening and call it out. You can do things that will fundamentally make other people aware and also shift what is normally just the status quo. So I think that's really the task with all of this is the awareness piece.
It was interesting. I was having a conversation with a university professor friend of mine who works both in behavioral science and diversity and inclusion. And she was doing this executive education class, and a woman came in, one of the students, and said, "Oh, look at my new tattoo." And the man who was talking to her goes, "Oh my God, that's so big. Did you get permission from your husband?" And it was like a very shocking moment for the two of them. But the next day, when she was sort of interrogating this and discussing this, it turns out the man was South Asian. He had grown up in an abusive household where his dad beat his mom. And it's the many ways in which we talk past each other, or we allow our fear or shame brain to not get us into these really rich conversations that get at things that are sort of sometimes terribly and sometimes wonderfully true. It's like, and I love how you say, like, it's your job to talk about this. And I certainly feel that way as well as a white straight man. But it is difficult because they're profound conversations.
Yeah, and look, I mean, there's a couple of things. So, you know, I've just taken on the role of the director of inclusion at Netflix. I've just started the beginning of this year. And, you know, something that I see in my work here and work that I've undertaken in the past is that what makes these conversations easier is when we approach them from a place of curiosity, right? So like in the case of, you know, that cultural difference, it's easy to get offended by that comment.
Sure.
Rather than digging in, right, and asking, hey, so why is that, or why do you think that, or help me understand that. So there's sort of a healthy curiosity that's missing today from this, because people are scared, and they're scared of this idea of that they're not a good person, you know. They're scared of this idea that they might have biases or they might have privilege. I mean, privilege is such a weighty word, right? Like, to say that, people are sort of shocked when you talk about that, but it's so important. And so I think for me in this work, like, there's two things. The first is, you know, when you're approaching these topics, you've got to let go of the idea or the need to be a good person, right? Like, you can mm-hmm. be a good person and still have bias. You can be a good person and still have privilege. Mm-hmm. You can be a good person and still have some racist beliefs that you need to tackle, right? Mm-hmm. And so this idea is really binary. We've got to let go of that. But the other piece I'll say to people is where the discomfort is in those conversations, so where you're feeling the rub and trying to shy away from it, that's where you got to lean in. I mean, I was in a conversation the other day where we were talking through the definition of privilege, right, which is like an unearned benefit that you get from one of your identities, whether that's white or, you know, being a man, like whatever your identity is, you get some sort of unearned benefit as a result of that. And I was in this group, and they had a really hard time with the term unearned. They just couldn't get over it. They couldn't move past it. And I said, that is exactly where you need to lean in and examine, why is it that I'm having such a hard time with it? And when we unpacked it, men were saying, because in particular this was an issue for men, you know, well, this feels like you're saying we haven't worked hard. And I'm like, no, nobody's saying men haven't worked hard. We're just saying, while you've worked hard, we've also worked hard, and it's still not sort of resulted in the same outcomes, because success discriminates. Success likes people who fit this ideal in workplaces. And so then that allowed for this whole conversation around the barriers. And so I think in this work, that's what's really important, is if you have the curiosity, it allows you to lean into those areas of discomfort, because you're not holding on to this idea of needing to be a good person.
Yeah, well, these cultural myths are so strong. I mean, you brought up meritocracy. I mean, this is, especially as an American, right? This is just, it feels like, well, isn't the entire country built on this? And then, you know, you seemingly wake up one day and you're like, well, no, that's not it at all. There's really no such thing that exists here when you look at who's getting into the Ivy League schools and who's entering the workplace at a certain point. And, you know, to understand that is then to be able to, I think, maybe have a more honest and thoughtful approach to other people who didn't have the same kind of advantages.
You know, I had such a funny experience with this week. So I'm working with this organization outside of this, and have been for a long time. And anyway, they were calling me up about my book, and they said, you know, we just want to pick your brain, see what you think about this. And I said, okay. They said, look, we're struggling with the word inequality. People don't like that word in the organization. We're wondering if we could just say that our workplace might not be, in some respects, a meritocracy.
Oh.
And I was like, look, I'm not rebranding this, so no. Like, my advice to you all is no. Like, we have to talk about things and hold on to the ideas. Yes, workplaces are not meritocracies, but the reason they're not meritocracies is because the inequality that exists out in the world comes into workplaces because people bring their biases and privileges and prejudice into the workplace. And so that's why organizations work the way they do. That's why there's so few women. And you know, the problem is when you sugarcoat these things, it also leads to some inherently misogynistic or racist ideas embedded in them. So when we, you know, deny privilege or we deny that, what we're inherently saying is that men are just that much better or smarter than women, and that's why they've succeeded. And so we have to actually look at sort of the systemic inequality that exists in workplaces that's hardwired to ensure that, you know, no matter how hard women try, you know, like I always say to women, you can do every single thing by the book.
Mm-hmm.
You can get more qualifications. You can get the best performance ratings. You can do everything. You can lean in till you're falling over, and still gender inequality can ensure that you won't succeed in workplaces. So I think knowing that is the starting point for realizing it's not you, it is your workplace. And if that's the case, how do we fix this together?
I thought it was interesting, and again, you referenced this before in terms of this isn't good for men either. You say in the book, quote, between 1965 and 2003, American men have more than doubled the time they spend on homework and childcare, end quote. But they haven't cut back at work, right? They're still pulling in those hours.
Yeah, so I think, so this is the interesting thing, right? So if you look at the total overall numbers, yes, that might have doubled, but it's still in reference to what was a very small number to start with, right?
Yeah, of course.
We just got to put it in context, because otherwise it sounds like, hey, the men are doing so much more. Like, they're doing more relative to their starting position, which was not very much or not at all. So, you know, my thing around men is, and it's full confession here, I realized that was a blind spot for me. So I realized, for me, I was in denial. When I started writing this book, and you'll see on the very first page, I wrote it for any woman who's at any point been made feel that they're not good enough, right? I really did. And that was my audience the whole time I'm writing. And I got halfway through, and I was running this whole conference as part of my PhD, and I was speaking to all these male leaders, and they did not like this message. And they were talking about how diversity and inclusion doesn't involve them. And I was getting a lot of pushback, and I was like, okay, I'm going to lean into my discomfort because I'm getting irritated that I'm getting this feedback from white men, and I'm going to go into the data. So I'm going to follow the approach. I'm going to be curious and go into the data. I'm going to try to understand what men are saying. So I spent like a couple of weeks just reviewing all the qualitative comments to really understand men's experiences of the current state of gender inequality. And what I found was consistently men were saying, you know, the focus on advancing women is the number one barrier to my career advancement, or diversity and inclusion programs don't include me, or it's really challenging for me as a father, or I don't like the culture here, but it's assumed that I do, or I can't speak up at work and I can't behave differently. And I started to see this pattern, and I realized I just assumed that the current state works for men, and I was wrong. And so I went back, and it took me a lot longer to finish my book as a result, but I then went and started again and did a whole sort of review of the academic literature out there on the challenges that inequality creates for men. And I wrote that up as a whole chapter around this idea of breaking up with this ideal worker image men have and how challenging that is for men. You know, men are forced into silence in workplaces. Men have the burden of being the breadwinner. It's very hard to move away from that. Men are not given the luxury of developing identities outside of work. And, you know, one of my favorite statistics is that when men even try to do that, right, so when they try to take up flexible work or reduce their work hours to kind of develop an identity outside of work, they face a 26% reduction in pay compared to women who face a 23% reduction. And more importantly, they're not seen as promotable. And it really negatively impacts their long-term career advancement because they're not living up to the shared ideal of what good looks like in workplaces, right? They're deviating from what is the masculine ideal. And so that's why, for me, like, you know, gender equality only serves to benefit men, right? It gives them the freedom to explore their identities outside of work, to speak up, to show up differently. You know, I could go on and on about this because there's so much research to show that, you know, even though women experience gender inequality in workplaces, when people just observe that, they're likely to have the same detrimental outcome. So, you know, that's such an incredible fact. Like, hey, just witnessing somebody being harassed or discriminated against or having sort of sexist comment or joke is going to negatively impact you in the same way as the person on the receiving end. And so that's why I always say, hey, you know, this is about all of us. Like, this is about men and women. So, yeah, I'm very passionate about the male piece because it's been a big learning for me. So I've enjoyed sort of getting to understand it.
Yeah, we co-created, we have a program called the Second Science Project at the University of Chicago with the Center for Decision Research that looks at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation. And we basically developed the orientation program for University of Chicago. And the very first workshop is called Hearing One Another. And it's really based on this idea of individuation, getting people to see the other person as having a mind, getting them to see them as more than one thing. So we created these improv exercises where they're sort of forced to see all the different sides of individuals. And the minute they do that, and so along with, you know, there's that data around, you know, if someone's homophobic and a gay couple moves in next to them, it takes something like 6 months for them to start to shed away that because they see these other people as human beings. And it really is that means it's a human being problem. It's all of our problem. It's not just one set of people's issue to solve.
Yeah. And I think, to be honest, I mean, I talk a lot about this in my book about the idea that current solutions put in place aim at fixing women. And by that, I mean a lot of the solutions focus on, you know, what women can do differently to fit into sort of man-made world of work. So, you know, asking women to speak up more or power dress or assert themselves or lean in, like that's all from a place of, you know, can you find a mentor, get a sponsor, attend a course, work harder, get more qualifications, do all the stuff so that you fit in, right? Mm-hmm. And so the problem with that is it kind of makes inequality women's problem to solve.
Right.
And the messaging is sort of, it's there in the background, right? And it's reinforced. And when organizations put all these programs in place, it makes people think, wow, the organization's doing all the stuff for women. Why is this not working? It must be women. They must really be not as competent, right? And the reality is that's just not the case. You know, the issues that women experience in workplaces actually have very little to do with them. And 9 times out of 10, it's sort of inherent in the policies, practices, programs, and quite frankly, personal beliefs that a lot of organizational leaders have. And so it's really that we're trying to fix and shift and move. You know, how are we behaving? What are the values that we're sort of inherent in this organization? What gets rewarded? What gets punished? What gets called out? You know, it happens in those day-to-day moments. And the problem is right now there's no room for that in the dialogue. Like, you have most of the diversity inclusion initiatives today aim at, like, targets. You know, can we just put more women into an organization, right, even though the organization isn't a great place for them? So it doesn't really enroll anybody. Like, you know, women are frustrated by it too because they're being asked to do so much. Men are kind of left out of the discourse, and in no point does anybody, I mean, you can walk in, I'd almost take this bet, right? You can walk in most organizations today and ask an employee, hey, how are you practicing equality or how do you practice inclusion just as part of your day-to-day job? And they will struggle. They will struggle to tell you how they're doing it. And that's the disconnect we have to solve for.
So you probably started writing this book, what, 4 or 5 years ago, I'm guessing? 3?
No.
Longer?
I started last year.
Oh, my God. How do you do this?
Well, I started my PhD a long, long time, well, 4 years ago. So I came
with
a
wealth notes.
Of research. Yeah,
okay.
The actual book was in a record space of time, I feel.
So you write in the book, and this is why I asked this, quote, as diversity and inclusion efforts increased over the last decade, discrimination went undercover, end quote. I'm kind of feeling like we're moving more into more explicit bias right now. I mean, do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the sort of public outbursts, which is kind of, I think, very new for us over the last, like, decade or two.
Yes, that's funny, right? Because there's this weird dynamic at play, particularly, I'll talk about America, but particularly in the States, right, where you've got, like, the Me Too movement that's calling out, like, sexism and, you know, talking about sexual harassment and all the challenges with that, which is just phenomenal. Like, to hear women's stories and the power of storytelling and disrupting people's denial, right? Because people are like, oh my God, I had no idea that was going on. Meanwhile, like, the gender equality experts are like, kidding me, right? So it was a great way to kind of disrupt it. But then the whole focus from solutions from that went to, okay, so now we need to do sexual harassment training. We need to do all this. And my whole message, and I talk about in the book in the last chapter, was sort of a very personal example of something I experienced in an organization, is that by the time you got into sexual harassment, you know, we failed women.
Yeah.
Like, a bare minimum for women is psychological and physical safety, right? That's a bare minimum. And we shouldn't have to ask for that bare minimum. Like, that organization should have that in place, right? What we're actually asking for is to be valued and treated in the same way as our male counterparts. And that doesn't necessarily mean consistent treatment. It means identifying us as individuals, understanding our individual needs, understanding what we can contribute to organizations, and creating a work environment that matches that and harnesses that. And that's not currently happening, right? But the problem is when you have sort of a lot of the focus on sort of quite blatant forms of discrimination or sexism coming to the surface, and then you have all these solutions that companies put forward, which invariably result in, like, women getting trained, or, you know, they're sort of blanket solutions that don't actually address the root cause of the inequality, which tends to be culture.
Yeah.
It gaslights people into thinking, hey, a whole bunch of things are happening. And, you know, and this issue's been solved. Great, we can all move on. And so what you find then is discrimination does go undercover, because it happens sometimes. You know, you have the overt forms, which are sort of sexual harassment. Then you have the more covert forms, which are very dangerous. And the barriers I outline in my book address all of these, which is really sort of, it's subtle, right? It's the microaggressions. It's you know, excluding women from sort of certain events. It's the way men network without even thinking about including women. It shows up in just those subtle day-to-day sort of barriers that are next to impossible to necessarily overcome. Like, you can navigate it to survive it, but you're never going to thrive in a workplace that has a lot of these barriers in it. And so I think, hopefully in this book, you know, we're shedding light on what is quite an undercover issue. I mean, a lot of the barriers I sort of even educated myself on that I didn't even know of, particularly like when it comes to women of color. So I think it's really important that, you know, that awareness piece again, just in terms of what is the problem we're trying to solve.
So I was on a call about an hour before we started recording with, we're developing a program with Thrive Global, and you've written for Thrive, and it's around culture, and we're doing a couple things where we're, one, using comedy as a way to tee up these issues, because we find that that's a wonderful way to talk about the elephant in the room and allow people to kind of, you know, you deal with a taboo subject without, you know, completely just freezing up. But then we're also talking about our improv principles, because they are these moments, right? Meaning is made in moments. Culture is made in moments and behavior. And actions. And you talk in the book about that the ideas around inequality is not in university courses or in corporate education programs or leadership development. And I'm sort of curious, in your position now at Netflix, it's like you've got to think about now a whole other kind of systematic approach to this issue, which is maybe results in these moments. You know, is it a moment by moment thing you're teaching people, which is, you know, to be curious, to ask questions, both of themselves and others, to get to know people at a deeper level? How do you put this stuff into action?
Yeah, so look, I mean, I think at an individual level, there's definitely the three things, right? So the first is like, the awareness piece, right? Mm-hmm. So being curious, trying to and that's at the level of the self. So trying to understand, like, hey, what are my identities? So am I a white male? Am I a white American male? Like, what are some of the identities I have, and what might be some of the privilege associated with that? And how does that then make it challenging for other people? So just first being curious about this and being curious about how inequality works. I mean, and this is my biggest beef with male leaders and female leaders too, but more so men, is like, you know, how many male leaders can actually say how inequality works in workplaces? And if they can't or don't know the barriers women face, how can they possibly give women advice or support women to advance? So I think a lot of it is that awareness piece and being curious about yourself and then others, right? And that then leads to understanding, which is, so do we understand how this shows up in our workplaces? Mm-hmm. Do we understand, you know, for me, I know as a white woman that I carry a lot of privilege being white. And that things are just that much easier for me because I naturally fit the ideal being white, right? I have difficulties as a woman, but it's a lot easier for me because I'm white. And so I make it my mission to understand the barriers of women of color experience. And I make it my mission, with that understanding, to take action to mentor and support and sponsor women of color in the organization who are talented and experienced and overly qualified, quite frankly, to take my position. And it's literally a mission I have. Like, from the moment I enter workforces, to identify women that I can support, and if they're not there, to get them in and then mentor them through. And so, you know, I think that's what it is, you know, once you have that awareness and you have that understanding of yourself, but also of how that's then showing up for other people, you know when to take action. I mean, the biggest issue I have with all this stuff to date is the actions we're taking are not informed. So they're lazy, quite frankly. So when organizations grab like an unconscious bias program off the shelf, it's lazy. It's like, you know, studies show that unconscious bias training is really unhelpful. Like, it actually reinforces bias. And that's because, you know, it's unconscious that people are like, hey, you know what, I don't have to do anything with it. And like, we need to move away from just identifying the biases we have and engaging in sort of what we call marginalization porn, right, which people love. Like, ooh, I'm biased, and let's talk about that too. How do you become a conscious decision maker? So how do you become somebody that understands in the moment where your bias is showing up and what action you can take? And, you know, that's the work. That's what we really, where we need to make that shift. And it's not easy, but it starts with you, like with each of us.
So you live in Texas.
I now live in LA.
Oh, now you're in LA. So, okay. So now, oh, even better. So like South Africa to Texas to LA. I mean, that seems like a dramatic cultural shift, a cultural shift, a cultural shift.
It is. I've also lived in quite a few countries in between there. So I've lived in Malaysia, New Zealand, Australia, the UK. Yeah, so some other cultures. And I love it. Like, I think it's great. It gives you a different perspective. You see inequality show up in different ways. But the interesting thing about it is it's actually really universal. Irrespective of where I've lived, inequality is the same.
Yeah.
It consistently shows up in terms of valuing one thing over another. Like, even in sort of some of the Asian cultures I've worked in, you know, there are hierarchies in between different sort of racial groups within that Asian structure. So it's really interesting. And so inequality literally is that, and it just shows up consistently irrespective of where you're living.
I'm going to ask you in a second for your yes and story, but you brought up a really interesting point in the book, which made me think is like these initiatives and corporations around diversity of thought feels to me like all lives matter. have we shifted, you know what I'm saying? Have we shifted the conversation to get away from the conversation we should have been having?
I don't think so. I think it's more a case of, no, I don't think so. I think it's, you know, I'm very much a proponent of Black Lives Matter.
Yep.
And I think it's more, of course, you know, all lives matter. Nobody's taking away from that. But what we're saying is let's understand why it is that in some communities or some parts of America, people don't see that and don't understand why there's the need for that. Mm-hmm. Why is it that people, for example, have an issue with the term Black Lives Matter? Why do you have an issue with that? And how do you not understand why that's needed in America? You know, what have you not been hearing? What do you not understand about the racial inequality that is systemic in America, mm-hmm. and why it's so important to celebrate sort of African-American people and understand what action we all need to take to make sure that they're not only safe, but that they can thrive in America? Like, how is it that you don't understand that? So when I hear those sort of blanket terms thrown out there, I feel myself bristle, because immediately I'm like, okay, we've got a lot of work to do, because clearly people don't understand why there is a need for this. You know, it's like when men push back, it's a similar thing, when men push back at work on, you know, why do we need this diversity program? Mm-hmm. And I had a male partner in a law firm tell me the other day that I was speaking at, you know, I don't really get this stuff. I don't know why we need it. And so I'm like, wow, okay, so we're right at the beginning of this journey where the awareness hasn't even started, right? And there's not even a curiosity to explore. And so that's where the hard work begins. And that's what I'm seeing in a lot of, you know, different pockets. I am hopeful, though, because then I see, you know, leaders who do get it, or leaders that I've worked with, one guy, you know, in particular, white male partner, and I took him from that place to where he is today. It was a long journey. It was like a couple of years, but he was in denial, and we disrupted it through the power of storytelling and sharing women's different accounts of the workplace. And now he's in an entirely different place, right? He's spearheading some of this, like he's still on his journey, but he's spearheading some of this within his own workplace. So it is possible. Like, I am hopeful.
That's good. Okay, so we ask every guest to tell us a yes and story. In the parlance of improvisation, you get nowhere when you're groups of people making something out of nothing. You get nowhere by saying no, and you can't stop at yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a story for us?
Yes. So I was asked yesterday, I was speaking at a conference, and I just finished the talk, and I was then sitting with a panel, and there were four women of color on this panel, and it goes to Q&A, and a white woman standing by the microphone, and she looked a little angry, and I was reading the air around her, I could see that she was not happy, right?
Oh, no.
And she asks her question. She says, "You've talked a lot about white privilege on this panel. What evidence do you have this is even real? I feel like this is just used to make white people feel bad." And of course, this room, women, like, all just,
yeah.
Like, and I said, yes, and I'm going to answer this question, out of respect for the woman on the panel. As a white woman, this is my question to answer to another fellow white woman. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to explain why this is your job to educate yourself. It's not actually a requirement for me to defend it, but let's go. And so I spent the next, I don't know, 15 minutes outlining all the research to get to put that to one bed, right, as to how this plays out, how it was just explaining it in a gentle way. But then we shifted to, so why is it that you don't know this? And why, you know, how can we, like, what is your journey that you need to take in making yourself aware so that you're not standing up here defending a position that actually is inherently racist? Because what you're saying is, if this doesn't exist, then white people have succeeded and maintained their position of dominance in society just simply because they're that much better. There is no other explanation that it could possibly exist,
right,
if you're not going to account for inequality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that session finished, and I didn't know how it was received, right? Because I could see it was quite an emotional session for the room.
Yep.
And as I was leaving, like, I didn't think twice, because I'm like, that's my job as an advocate, right? It's just what I do. And three African-American women came up to me, and one of them had tears pouring down her cheeks. And she said, she put her hands on my shoulder, and she said, "Never in all our time of going to conferences or work have we had a white woman call out another white woman on a view that is inherently racist."
Mm.
And, you know, we really appreciate that, and that's what advocacy is, and we can't believe you did that. And thank you for not expecting any of the women of color on the panel to address that question.
Mm.
And it didn't even occur to me, and it was in one of those powerful moments where I was like, oh, wow, that is actually what allyship looks like. So I just want to encourage anybody, you know, thinking about that story, if you're getting asked a question where you're like, hey, I'm going to shy away from that, or I don't want to ask that, like, think about, hey, is this where I can actually lean in as an ally and explain the position and have the difficult conversation in a respectful way, and actually explain why, you know, this is part of the work. So yeah, that's my yes and answer, and I think it was a very powerful moment for me.
Totally. And it strikes a great line you have in the book where you say tackling inequality in your workplace isn't an obligation, it's a privilege. And that is just being, you know, a good human being to another human being. And so I think that that sort of powerfully comes through in this book, which is evidence-based. It's all backed up by data, and your specific stories, too. So I thank you for writing it.
No, thank you so much. It's been my great privilege to be in a position to be able to write it. So thank you.
The book is called The Fix, Overcome the Invisible Barriers That Are Holding Women Back at Work. Michelle King, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
million feet.
Adulthood, no one survives.